So it's really a pleasure to welcome Roz Goddard to our Ledbury Poetry Salon. And I'll just give a brief introduction to Roz, and then Roz is going to read for about 15 minutes, and then we're going to have a conversation, and I will encourage everybody to join in because we're such an intimate group. So Roz will be reading from Spill, which is a new pamphlet that's just come out, really hot off the press. When did it come out?
Well, it launched February the 11th.
Right, yes. So there we are, hot off the press, very exciting.
Yes.
And that is published by Flairstack, which is a wonderful press. And that follows from Roz's previous pamphlet, which was The Soprano Sonnets and Other Poems, which was a Nine Arches pamphlet. And I would also like to mention that Roz is a long-time poet-in-schools poet for the Ledbury Poetry Festival, probably right from the beginning of the programme, I think, when Fran started it. So it's really lovely. It's really lovely to be able to chat with Roz in a completely different context, but it's also been a real privilege watching and being part of the process of seeing Roz inspire and work with all these young people, which has happened over so many years. So that's really amazing. And we've done the Poetry and Song Project, haven't we? We've done the Keen Writers Workshops, when all the really enthusiastic pupils come together from different schools and are challenged to push their poetry further. So wonderful things there. I would also like to mention that Roz is currently a Room 204 writer development poet, programme poet. And I thought that might be of interest because some people are poets, and it's a Writing West Midlands Emerging Writers Scheme. So that's something interesting to know, and also a possible thing to look at too if you're interested. Roz has won the 2015 Interpreter's House Poetry Competition and also been shortlisted for Bridport and Manchester Cathedral Poetry Competitions. And finally, to say that one of the poems in the pamphlet, Talking to Mother Reborn in the Heaven of the 33 Gods, came out of an LPF event, a Ledbury Poetry Festival event last year at the 2017 festival, which was the Enemies Project, pairing poets together and challenging them to it. So I might ask Roz about that, because I'm curious a bit to know a bit about that. But more importantly, let's welcome Roz and hear her poems.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that introduction. And it's so wonderful to be in Ledbury reading some new poems. I was just saying to Chloe, it was 1998, my first Ledbury Poetry Festival, when I was doing something called the Poetry Squantum up in the Feathers Hotel. And the host was Sarah Maguire. And it was a case of four poets working on work in progress over a weekend in front of a live audience. And I remember we were eating, and Sarah Maguire said, "There is no way that you would get me doing, you know, I'm happy to host, but I will not show my work in progress." And I thought that was really quite interesting, you know, that somehow you had to let down your perfectionism and just go, this is what I did 2 hours ago. And sometimes that can be quite difficult, I think. So it's really lovely to be here. I launched my last collection at the Ledbury Poetry Festival in 2010. And those of you who are writers will know that writing is not a kind of linear process, is it? Mm-hmm. You know, you think, oh, I'll crack this, I can write some poems. But actually, you know, in the intervening 8 years that it's taken me to get another collection together, such highs and lows and false starts and issues. And you know, I think perhaps that's something that we can touch on. I think a huge impetus for me in terms of my writing, a transformation, really happened about 2 years ago. I've been involved with Buddhist study for around 12 years and have a meditation practice, but came across a Buddhist order in 2016 that has had a really big impact on my life. The study, my involvement, as my close involvement at the centre in Birmingham. It's the Triratna Buddhist Order, and those of you who know Adisthana will know that Adisthana up the road is part of the Triratna Buddhist Order. So I'd just like to open with a few poems about my Buddhist practice. This one is called Birmingham Buddhist. With sorrow lapping like small tides, I come to the city of shining attics. Snow turned the world soft hours ago. Tonight we can only walk. Look back at our footsteps as they met the corner, slipped a curb, steady ourselves on the silver waypost of a plane tree. At the centre, a Buddhist is waiting in the lobby. Welcome, he says. A scatter of snow follows me in, spangles our feet. Have you come far? A soft beat beneath my heart, like water passing over a stone. I've been walking all my life, wearing out stilettos, platform soles, to find a place like this, I think. Not far, just a few miles, I say. Make yourself at home. The bell will sound when it's time to sit, he says. So I do. One of the ways that I think Buddhism has transformed, altered, changed me is to tenderise my heart. This is called In the Shrine Room. The Buddha's head is a crown of snails, palm a landform at the mouth of a river. I light candles, spark an incense stick and kneel. This suit of armour is steel, stitched with strips of leather, bulletproof against strife, daily revolts, duels where I am called upon to draw a sword, defend myself against insurgencies. Under the breastplate, my heart is a wren, blushing. Take it from its bowl of ribs, feel its gentle heat, run your thumb beneath its barred wing. Watch it weep. When I turn up to meditate almost daily, so I have this meditation practice, it doesn't get any easier at all. And this poem is written from right at the beginning of my meditation practice. So it doesn't get any easier. I don't know how to do it any better. I just understand the process a bit more. Monk. Full of shadow, the monk's eyes are two knowing moons as he stares over our heads. Drawn to the wintered, I show up to meditate, manage only more scattering. Birds are too loud in the plane tree. My friend is disappearing in her hospital bed and the windows won't open. My mother appears silently with a plate of Welsh cakes. I think this is how she spent her whole life, in a summer dress, invisible, bearing gifts. I open my eyes when they should be closed, watch the monk, a warrior, in his stillness. Wonder what brought him to this backwater, to alter the air, and teach us how to breathe. It's interesting what we remember, isn't it, from childhood, the images that we have that have stuck with us, that have a real kind of emotional resonance. And this poem I'm going to read, so this would have been about 1972. We had a phone installed at our house. Big deal. You know, along with a colour TV around about the same time. And it was a kind of thing amongst my peer group that if you had a phone, they would kind of prank call and just ring the number. Our number was LI4495, I always remember it. Ring, 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 and then when somebody picked it up, put it down again. And this used to happen time and time again. And it used to send my father bananas. This is called Spaceman. It was the summer of malign storms, rain humming in muslin, bursting grey from the weight, ready to drown. The telephone kept ringing, the dread bark of it in the clammy hallway, bowls of laughter down the line before it went dead. My father, furious, sparked the Renault, roared away through hot waiting streets, tunnelled under the heat of an electric sky. I imagined him in the first wave of rain, silver drops exploding on the screen, stopping at every telephone box, hauling out knots of kids and lining them up. He'd make them ashamed as their clothes soaked to ink for nothing, for being alive. It was only a matter of time for his heart, full from the months of grief, to open a fresh vent for the wide glowing river of fury to run for hot miles, snake out of our town and into the next. It was never meant for those innocents, but for my mother, for the invisible, never-to-be-born brother, floating like a spaceman, wide-eyed and lifeless in her womb. These are two poems about my father, kind of following on. I was absolutely devoted to my father. When he was dying, he was dying of a brain tumour, and the effect of it was to alter his personality somewhat, so that he began to tell the truth, where previously he hadn't necessarily always told the truth. So these are two poems about my father. First one is called The Truth Cardigan. My father is being poisoned by yellow seeds ground into his porridge. My mother bleaches the bowl, leaves no trace. He tells the doctor this, then weeps. His stories are poetry, full of things he never loved and didn't do. It's the truth, Cardigan, my mother says. He wears it all the time these days. Says terrible things we never knew to doctors and strangers. There's a museum not too far away from here that is the Museum of Water, and lots of different types of water have been collected in various receptacles, so I imagined what it would be like to have my father's bath water in a kiln jar on the mantelpiece. So this is my father's bath water in a kiln jar. On cold days it clouds, a small fog behind glass, and your back smoking. Are there panatellas in heaven? A back room to sit and watch the snow. Do you jaunt off and come back with puppets in brown paper, antique spiders, spoons no one can use? This water is precious to me, mountain clear, grey, flat as the sea. Do you still dream of crowning the 22-metre line of a gold cup for your roses in the county show? I've heard frosts are hard, that clouds sparkle and ring in the cold. Do you still sing? I think I'm obsessed with love. You know, when I was putting this set together, I just thought, all these poems are love poems in one way or another. You know when you those of you who are writers and you think about what your territory is, because we all have a territory, don't we? As thinkers, I think, as personalities, as people, but certainly as writers, and I was thinking my territory is the heart, how we love, how we fall out of love, how difficult love can be, the pickles that we get into when we're in love. And one of the forms that I particularly like in poetry is the dramatic monologue, you know, because what it does is it kind of allows you to put on a mask and to say things that you wouldn't normally say. And honestly, the number of dramatic monologues I have got children in Ledbury to write over the years, there must be hundreds around Ledbury and outlying districts. And it is just something, I think, that, well, just people at all stages of their poetry careers can just pick up and run with. So I'm gonna read a few dramatic monologues. And this one, have you seen The Sound of Music?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is written from the point of view of the Baroness. Do you remember the Baroness? Mm-hmm. She died recently, I think. And so she had a fairly troubled relationship, I think you'd agree, with Maria. Perhaps none. I think she got a tough deal, actually. I didn't, you know, the Baroness. And so I thought, I'm going to write this poem from the point of view of the Baroness, kind of getting her own back on Maria to some extent, or just telling us her side of the story. The Baroness and the Nun. Driving away under the avenue of limes, the night he let me go, sick with love and shame, I trace my exile to those trees. That first glimpse of his children calling out like exotic birds in clothes she'd made from backroom drapes. The virgin seamstress turning chalice into silk, damn her eyes. Damn the angel in her throat, the gouts of singing every long, cold evening. God's own girl rising from the river, breasts trapped under dull linen, mouth an innocent red hollow full of futures. I hadn't a prayer. This was an interesting thing that happened to me a few years ago. I saw a portrait of George Dyer, who was the lover of Francis Bacon. You know, they had quite a troubled relationship. And isn't it interesting, those of you who work with visual art and portraiture, how you can be drawn by the underneath of someone. Actually, our underneath is written on our faces anyway, isn't it? If you get a chance, by way of diversion, there's a wonderful exhibition at Tate Britain at the moment that's on until August called All Too Human. And it is these amazing portraits of people and their complexity, you know? Anyway, I saw George Dyer, and he started speaking. I had his voice in my head, and I drafted this poem in about 10 minutes or so. You know, it's gone through a few drafts since then. But the mythology is around it is that George Dyer broke into the house of Francis Bacon, and that's how they met, and that's how their relationship began. Now, some people say that's not true. I don't care, you know, because actually you can use any old story and use it as a starting point, which I've done. So I've taken liberties here. So this is in the voice of George Dyer, and I want you to imagine that he's been in the pub all afternoon. excuse me, George Dyer slips the afternoon away. A robber's moon and Chiswick foxes strolling through the gate, dainty as you like. I come from the glory hole, drinking with a stranger for hours in the half-lit back room, a man with the blackest eyes I'd ever seen. He could handle me and me him, skin of an eel, skin of an eel. Then the party went to ash, wrong music on the jukebox, a blousy laugh from the street. He said too much, started on the romance side of it, Soho nights, meeting up, that lark. I scarpered to your place, Mr. Francis Bacon, Sir, Lord of the Bleeding Manor, Mr. Painter. Broke in through the back window looking for silver, and found you standing like one of your own crucified figures. You knew right then I was one of your men, wrecked somewhere and wild. You nodded toward the stairs, smiled, and I walked on broken glass to follow you up. And I'll finish this section with... I'm going to finish with my grandfather. So I was born in Merthyr Tydfil. And my grandfather was a miner. And now I live in the Black Country. So he mined all his life, and he had an early death from being a miner. And I live in the Black Country now, and I live not too far away from an old colliery. And I've never been in a colliery, and this is disused, you know. So one afternoon I broke in. This is called the break-in. On this slice of land, ragged with trees, risen from coal waste, hawthorn by buckeye by beech, wild specimens that lay root traps to keel you, stands the old colliery bathed in sun. A place of flood, the precise underground spot where rivers rise and multiply and water shines across the dark waste. I pick away over mulch paths, lichen rocks, to the red brick winding house, familiar as a church, crawl in through a cone of light. A gatekeeper stitches the afternoon, weakening sun leans, slices softly onto worn steps. I'm not meant for this place, under the wheel and pulleys, under the brace. I hear my grandfather's voice. Soft are you? Who in God's name would break into a colliery? The whites of his eyes are marble in his dark face. Holding a snap tin, he's been underground for 40 years. The air shaft, offering an adventure I can't name, is a perfect black hole. Summons me to make a wish, spin a coin into the water, lapping at an unknown edge. I don't answer, afraid of how at ease it seems. How inviting.
Thank you very much, Ros, for that reading to open. And there's so many interesting things you've raised there, which are... So, as I say, do feel free to join in. But I'll begin by asking a bit more about... you mentioned that 2 years ago you started to explore Buddhism, and that seems to have also been linked to some kind of shift with your writing. So it'd be nice to try and understand a bit more about that. And the comment you made about a tenderised... how it's something tenderised in your heart, I'd love to hear more about.
Yeah, I think one of the things that has happened over the last 2 years, I'm part of a study group at the Birmingham Buddhist Centre now, and I've been on a number of retreats, some led retreats. Most of them have long periods of silence. So there's a way in which one turns inward, turns towards one's own heart, own experience. And in doing so, in that process, what I've discovered, it's interesting what you do with your body when you're trying to, but it's about opening. It's about opening that I find that I have a greater openness with, and a greater compassion actually towards myself, and all of my foibles and frailties. And in that, I think what has happened is that I can turn towards some of the difficult things in my experience, some things that perhaps I wouldn't previously have spoken about. You know, it's called spill for a reason, revelation, shedding some light. And so I think it feels like my heart is much more open, tenderized, and that has had a huge impact on my ability to get underneath my experience and to write things in a different sort of way, in a more authentic way, in a more genuine way. So yeah, that's what I'm discovering.
Mm-hmm, that's interesting. And did you, so with the poems in this collection, are most of them, did you revisit poems in that new sort of spirit, or has a lot of things been written since then?
I think most of these poems have been written over the last few years, and some of the ones that I wanted to include but I'd written prior to 2016, I looked at with fresh eyes. And I think the main thing has to do with how honest am I being here? How truthful is a better word, I think. And sometimes what my, I love this, Hilary Mantel has this wonderful thing that she says about writing, and she said, stop being so charming, ditch the charm, ditch it. And that's always been an issue for me, you know, being charming, and I think leaving that to one side and being more of myself, you know, sort of warts and all. So yes, I revisited poems in that light, I think.
Okay, and when you talk about charm, are you talking about charm towards us as a reader, do you think? Or what was the, or was it more that you were in what you're trying to write to charm yourself as a writer somehow, or what?
I think what I mean by charm is that what you can do if you're not careful, and what I have done in the past, is to want to please and to write a pleasing poem, a poem that will go down quite well, or I think will go down quite well. But in doing so, that there is this big numb white patch somewhere in the middle where the feeling has been bypassed, or that you haven't actually got to the core of the experience. And so I think that's what I mean. There's a certain kind of, there can be a whimsicality about something, or a surface level. How far am I prepared to dig, I think, is just a question that I've been coming back to quite a lot over the last 2 years. And the poem that you referred to, that I'm going to read in the second half, Talking to Mother Reborn in the Heaven of the 33 Gods, what I'm discovering is that Buddhist stories, imagery, is also having a really interesting impact on my writing. So using some of those things as a vehicle to go a little bit deeper.
Interesting. And does that work in your revising process too, how you revisit? Have you noticed a different approach to how you rework or work with poems once the first draft's been written?
Yeah, I've always found, and I don't know, I'd be really interested to hear people's comments on this, but I have a very strong bodily sensation when I've got a decent first draft. And do you know that the other thing that I've discovered is don't listen to your mind. don't listen to what your head is telling you. Always listen to your body. And I think actually this is true in life generally. Oh no, I don't feel that. Oh no, I don't feel that. Actually, your body will tell you how you feel, you know. And so when it comes to drafting, I get a very visceral feeling that something is right. And when I've drafted a poem that's got more head than heart, then it's a bit sterile. Does that resonate with people?
Yeah.
Those of you who are writers?
I definitely feel it. If I've got a phrase and it's right, it's almost like a physical buzz.
Yeah.
And once I've got it down on paper, I can stop having to think about it.
Yeah.
That's the thing, I've got to get it on paper.
Yeah.
And I can tweak it a little bit afterwards. Yeah. But once it's down, I don't really change it that much.
No.
The odd word, take something out, condensed it. But it's got to be some phrase that's got to be there.
And it's catching that,
absolutely,
isn't it? And recognising it. And I think that comes with practice.
It's annoying in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But I remember it in the morning.
Yeah, keeping a notebook. Yes. Keeping a notebook there.
Yes, that's interesting, because we have a reading group, and one of the things we were talking about in the reading group was the this idea that writing poetry is a bit like dreaming. So you're writing into what you don't know, out of, as you say, out of something that's not known by your mind.
Yeah.
But it will be, but you, and it's sort of recognising, I suppose, when that's authentic, isn't it?
Is
possibly a challenge. It is, as you say, comes with practice, maybe.
It is. I think it is a challenge. I'm just about to run a course for Writing West Midlands around creative writing and mindfulness, because I'm absolutely convinced that a regular practice of mindfulness can really make a difference to your ability to access deeper feelings, but also to see the world in a different way. And that's been my experience, certainly over the last few years, and that's what I want to try and share with people. But yes, capturing that, recognising it, and not kind of tricking your, just getting your mind out of the way is the only way that I can describe it. Because, I mean, I genuinely feel that writing poetry is not an intellectual pursuit. You know, first and foremost, it is more when you get to the drafting stage and go beyond it and you're looking at form and all of that. But I think in the beginning, it's a heart. It really comes from the heart. And I think how do we regularly tap into that? Because it can be hard. Because we all get that little critic as well, don't we? That's rubbish. Don't even bother, you know, and all of that. But kind of bypassing.
And so therefore the Truth Cardigan poem is such a strong poem, in that obviously you're talking about your father and then there's the reflection on that kind of the poet's job of putting on a truth cardigan in some ways. Is that what?
That, you know, when my father was dying, it was he was at his most tender and vulnerable, and it was almost like the personality that he always had been was coming out. And so he used to say, not with any malice at all, but he used to say things that would totally floor us. And I've come to see that as a kind of gift. you know, when you recognise that he was just telling the truth. So, yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, Chloe, of the link between the two. But, yeah, maybe, actually, putting on a truth cardigan, actually physically putting something on, might be a very interesting thing. That's my truth cardigan. I'm putting that on today and seeing what happens.
I think it was also when you talked about the not lives he was taught, you know, this... I can't remember the exact wording used, but this idea of lives not quite lived and chances not taken, yeah, that sort of was in, yeah, the middle of the poem somewhere.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is obviously a hard thing, you know, hard to hear as a child of somebody, mm-hmm, I mean. But also, I suppose when I was thinking about the poem too, from the idea of a poet and taking truth as being something that you're invested in giving as a poet, that... Mm. You do it in your monologues too, don't you? It's that thing of it taking on lives you might not have had, or is that part of the attraction, do you think? And I suppose...
Yeah, yes. It's, you know, what would we say? What have we got to say? What are some of the things that are almost impossible to talk about? And I think that's the truth cardigan, getting to the very edge of one's life, and only at that point, because one is so debilitated by illness, is it possible to speak the truth, you know. And I found that, I still find it quite heartbreaking that is the case. And I think that's partly why I'm very invested in truth and honesty, and whether I am writing from my own experience or putting on a mask of some kind, that's what I want to do. I keep coming back to this idea of the underneath of things, which is so very different from the surface of things. Just because I think when you are truthful and authentic, it immediately resonates with people. You just know. And other people can recognise in their experience what you're talking about. You know, so for example, spill. If I spill, how does that resonate with your experience? You know, how... because all of the things that I touch on, basically what it means to be human in this collection, we've all been there with the heartbreak, the difficulties, the whole spectrum of human emotions. And I think that's really what I'm interested in as a teacher, particularly of adults, you know. Sometimes, obviously, I want that to happen with children as well, but I'm really wanting to encourage people to explore that scene that will touch others, that resonate in some way with other people.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's marvellous, because I do think that for some time the sort of world of poetry has... slightly been antagonistic towards the idea of truth, whether that's, you know, that they've, and it's, so it's kind of...
Yeah, yeah.
Refreshing. Can I say something? Yeah. Sorry, just, I also have a meditation practice, and I totally, when I meditate, it's like going into no mind place, and it is a place where I become much more embodied in my experience. So I totally understand your description of going underneath and then perhaps surfacing.
Yeah.
But viewing things from a different angle in a different place, and with any luck, just turning down the chatter of the mind. So I'm really getting that sense of stillness in your description and in your poem.
Oh, that is completely wonderful, because a very important practice for me at the moment, every single day, is I lie on the floor for half an hour and I am still. And it's rare for me in my life to do that, and it feels very important to just be and not be doing. You know, what did I read the other day? That having a busy life is a form of laziness. What? But when I actually started thinking about that, the distraction of a busy life actually is really what this philosopher was getting at. It really made me think I have to lie down even more. I mean, I have one, there is an order member in the Chiratna Buddhist Order who was talking about this very thing. And her practice, she said, I was just like a revolving door. And she said, I just lie down with a house brick on my stomach. Which I thought was just stop, you know. But I do identify with that.
This week in the Borderlands Film Festival, there was a film called Walk With Me about a Vietnamese.
Oh, Thich Nhat Hanh?
I don't remember. I wouldn't be able to pronounce his name. But he's got a house in France.
Yeah. Plum Village. That's yes. Right.
And he talks about mindfulness, very much about mindfulness.
Mm.
And it's about being in the present.
Yeah.
It sort of taps into Lucretius and Epicureanism. It's about just being aware of now.
Yes.
But finding some stillness in this.
Yeah. I haven't seen that film. I've heard great things about it.
Mindful.
Yeah.
Slow, measured, very mindful.
So. Great. Thank you.
And has it also, do you think there's a sense where your relationship with your memories is it shifting through the, because there's a lot of poems that are about a place, Merthyr, which you go back to often, and they're very vivid. I don't know if everyone else felt that, but when I was thinking, wow, the detail, it's, you know, the precision of them, and is that, do you find you have memories coming back as you meditating at all, or how to, or is that something that, I mean, it's a searching in memory is a form of meditation, is it?
Yeah, it's fascinating that what, you know, what we carry with us and what links we have, what threads we have. So both my parents died many years ago. And so I was 60 last October, and there is something about turning 60 and experience and memory, family, place, where do you belong? And I think because I've lived in the Midlands, in the Black Country, I mean, I went to university in Nottingham and came back to the Midlands. So I was born in Merthyr, lived there for 3 years, came to the Midlands. So where is my home? Where do I belong? So I think really thinking about, there's a poem in here called If Merthyr Called Me Back. I mean, if Merthyr called me back, I'd be horrified. I mean, and my extended family is in Merthyr, but I don't visit very much. And there's a certain kind of romanticism for me, my memories. Mm. You know, my gran and granddad lived in a prefab. He was a miner. And I don't know, there's something kind of vaguely kind of sepia tinted, but actually the reality of Merthyr is really grim, you know, and my extended family have had lots of difficulties and so on, but I have found that I've wanted to revisit what Merthyr has meant to me, because it's part of me and yet I don't belong, and that's a strange feeling. I don't belong in the Midlands either, but I belong more in the Midlands than I do in Merthyr. Mm-hmm. You know,
when I was a student, I went to Aberystwyth University, and while I was there, there was an LP that came out of compilations of Welsh bands, and it was entitled Dial M for Mercer.
That's quite a good
That's yeah, a great title.
I still have it in the
Dial M for Mercer. Yeah.
And there are beautiful, there's a beautiful poem where the star appears in the butcher's. And that's a kind of, yes, that takes this wonderful leap into some eternity.
Yeah,
how did that happen?
I don't know, I'm going to read that later.
Oh, good, because that's a super.
Yeah, I think I'm more interested now in moving beyond my experience into these other absolute flights of fancy, you know. And I had great fun writing that and talking to Mother Reborn, which does a similar sort of thing. So it feels really quite exciting to move into this other territory.
Wonderful. Well, that seems like a perfect moment then to bring back to the poems. We've got an extra time, so don't
forget. Okay, thank you. So, how long do you want me to read?
Well, I would say just in 15 minutes.
Okay, that's
great. Because we started late, so...
Okay. Ah, yes. Visual art. That's another big thing. I've got this wonderful collection of visual art postcards that I take into schools and get the children to choose, and we write stories based on them. They write monologues, and so I use visual art quite a lot. I'm going to start with another monologue, and this is do you know the piece about Magritte with the bowler hat, man in the bowler hat. So I was working with that as a piece, and it was the bowler hat that got me, and this is where the poem took me. And as Chloe's just saying, you know, the star poem that I'm going to read goes off into a flight of fancy. Goodness only knows why this came from the bowler hat, but there it did. It's called Dawn After the Party. I've walked to the marsh in a bowler hat, from the wedding party where my lover is with another man in the cattle barn. I want to go shopping with him for spoons and a good towel, stare at stacks of bread in the bow window of a corner shop. His tie, full of imagined seas, was trampled in the stall under his brogue, spoiled with slurry. I want him to ask, "What did you dream last night, Alfred?" I'll tell him about the juggernaut of tulips, how it came down the avenue slowly but couldn't cross the small bridge, that the driver threw open the doors and the cargo of flowers was a torrent of white like a salt cloud. So yes, love. I'm going back to love. The Emma Press last year called for some poems based in Birmingham, around the city, and so this, my idea was to have this man come to the city to meet a woman he hasn't met her yet. Perhaps they've corresponded or something, but he's half in love before he gets to the city. It's called Summertime. The Penzance train slips into a tunnel of silver. In the darkening glass, he's 10 years younger, awake again, chest a cage of dancing birds. "I'll be waiting," she said, "head for the cathedral. If someone asks for change, be generous. Be generous twice. I like to watch a man meeting the world before a storm of words gets in the way." Beyond the station, tram lines guide him. He feels the city's welcome in noon heat, plane trees offering shade, the boulevard's pale spread. Come in, come in. He likes the sound of his Birmingham woman, imagines them opening a door to a cool room, stilling the hours, waking in a different day, her urgent whispered instructions in dawn light. The cathedral's golden stone is suddenly close, blue meltwater in the ascension window. She's here somewhere in the lunchtime spill. He feels a hand on his hand, a kiss. Hello. When Jackie Rowe, my editor, was putting this together, she said, there are a lot of plane trees in these poems. And I, when I read, oh, I absolutely adore plane trees. And the other thing is spoons. I've been married 34 years this year. And those of you who are in long relationships will know that it's not always a bowl of cherries. Am I right? I think one of the archbishops talked about the heroic nature of long-term relationships, and I thought, brilliant word, heroic indeed. And this just kind of explores a little bit of that. It's called Goldfish on the Coast. How close we came to leaving each other on the hard shoulder, walking in different directions, following the line of fields for lonely miles, then hitching a lift, me toward the sea, you with a spirit level back to the Midlands. It would have been dark by the time you put your key in the lock, let yourself into the cool hush. Prayer plants folded, landing light blown, and the dog staring into the night, expecting me to sing his name. I'd have steadied myself on the coast, bought a 2-slot toaster, ruined a few heels on the cobbles of the old town swaying home. There would have been other men, a goldfish, gulls screaming overhead, but no cause for concern, none whatsoever. One of the things that, that Buddhism does for you is asks you to think about death quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And I responded to, Joe Bell was doing an online Guardian workshop, and she posed the question, what is left of you when you die? What's the sort of personal archaeology that you leave behind? So I'm imagining that I drop dead and someone has a rifle through my wardrobe, basically. This is called Travels Quite Soon After My Death. There's a half glass of Sauvignon, bubbles clinging to the side, the tiniest of ball bearings, then pop. Fingerprints on the IKEA glass, whirls of secrets holding my life, a complete circular ridge, one inside the next, featuring Merthyr with its rivers, deltas, clues to the Welsh lippy gene, the random fire, a desire for silk jersey, the low notes of vetiver. Shudder the wardrobe door, go on. And there I am, in purple and cashmere, on the cheap. In the field of seabed colours, the depth of green, born of water's coldness. There's lime and pistachio, the sharpness of spring, and rust for a future autumn. The velvet of slimmer decades, and a breast of sequins for Shirley Bassey moments. Handbags of dust and old pencils, a tube map all marked up near places my children used to live. The red Buddhist notebook, terribly thumbed and greasy from the effort of reading. And behind all this, a Velcro hair roller of my mother's, tangled with strawberry strands, as if only yesterday my hands sat lightly on her shoulders. And it's International Women's Day, the day after tomorrow, I think. So, yeah, I'm going to read the poem that Chloe mentioned, called Star, in honour of International Women's Day star. On the butcher's block, sluiced and dried and benign with readiness, lay a star. Morning, after the delivery of eggs and the careful spread in cabinets of hand and spring, black pudding, blade and brisket, knuckle and shin, the cool positioning of loin and a bloody palm wave to Mrs. Jenks, after the ribbing of young assistant Sam about his girl and the taking of inferior coffee, he turned to it. Pulling his cleaver from where it hung, he stripped its skin, hands turning silver as he tore and sliced and struggled to keep hold of its still warm heart, its beat soft as the pulse of a sister star light years away. Blood was unexpected. He imagined primitive rain, the ancient remnants of a stellar wind, not the salt sea smell of his own mother, the tang of mature woman at its core. Left it quartered there, bones sore quite clean, strode through the kilos of light, rustled the fly curtain to where the morning was neutral. And I'm just going to finish with two poems. This poem was written after my experience of volunteering in a hospice, and it's called Touch. That first morning at the hospice, I hung out with the ambulance men cracking jokes on the terrace. We were on the sunny side, a little club of the well, with our smiles and grand summer schemes. Inside, I was afraid to step into the circle where the dying sat, serious gods with their own laws and freight of terrible plans, as if in their territory there was no love or laughs or splashes of gin. Months later, when I'd grown up, I held Gwen's hand and found her skin, like mine, warm, craving touch. And I'm going to finish with the poem that, came out of this wonderful collaboration as part of the Ledbury Poetry Festival last year with Sarah James, where we collaborated on the idea of grief. We took grief as our central idea and interpreted it in different ways. And this is what I call Talking to Mother, Reborn in the Heaven of the 33 Gods. Mother, though you are pale, your lips are hibiscus, full as the hem on a dancing girl's skirt, sun stitched into the narrow pleats of your silk coat. Look at you now, your fingers poised for music, no trace of soil from the arc of calendulas you planted behind the house. The appraising stare is new, as if you see my eyes shadowed with dust and wish to thumb the ignorance away. There is a time for silence, Mother. It is not now. I have made this journey. Where are the 33 gods? I imagined them silent in a cloister, skulls bare to eternity, or quietly treading heaven's mountainous paths. Are there mountains up here, Mother, or a place to sit and simply think? Do you jaunt off for afternoons, return worn out with apostle spoons and ask for tea? You are different, better dressed, serene like those murmuring commandos we encountered and mistook for novice monks. So, you are keeping this heavenly knowledge to yourself for now. I understand. It's starting to rain. Soon this bower will be drenched with the scent of bluebells. There is nothing like seeing a person you love again, Mother. The way it alters all things and makes the world suddenly full of birdsong and yellow umbrellas. Thank you.